I had a meditation experience this morning where I was able to realize that the experiences I was having are not my true me, and I wasn't able to directly experience being, but I could experience as being. And then I had a realization that as being, even experiencing the objects of experience, is being itself. And I was wondering if that's an example of what you meant of being experience being.
Take off your PhD hat. That's it. You're overthinking this. You're missing the obvious. Can you say from your experience now, I am?
Yeah. Yes.
To what experience do you refer that enables you to say so?
It's something I've always experienced.
That's very true. But when I ask you, can you say from your experience now, I am, you pause. In that pause, do you go to the sensation of your hand on the mic?
No.
Do you go to your thoughts?
No.
Do you go to your memory of childhood?
No.
Where do you go? Because you went somewhere. I asked you, can you say of your experience, I am? Pause. And you said yes. Where did you go in that pause that enabled you to answer yes to that question?
I guess it wasn't a place, or it was just...
No, don't guess, oh. Brand. Because if you had guessed, you would have said, I think so. But you didn't. You said yes.
Yeah.
I can say from my experience, I am. Now, from what experience can you say I am?
It felt like a self-evident experience.
It is indeed self-evident experience. Yeah. What is that self-evident experience? You're absolutely right.
I guess the only words I have are like the I am or I exist or the experience of being or knowing.
Yeah, the experience of being.
Yeah. Oh, okay. That's it?
I'm afraid so.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Think about it. Now you can start thinking again. I ask you the question, can you say from your experience, I am?
Yes.
And you can say, yeah, but imagine that in that pause, you did not have the experience of being. You would have answered no. But can you imagine legitimately answering no to the question, can you say from your experience, I am?
No.
It's inconceivable that you would say no. Why? Because the experience of being is so self-evident and obvious, so self-evident and obvious that we look too far ahead. We overthink, what is this extraordinary, what that the enlightened sages talk about? That's what I mean when I say it's the most simple, the most obvious, and the most intimate experience there is. So simple, obvious, and intimate, you can't experience in subject-object relationship, and therefore you think you're not experiencing it. You're expecting it to be some marvelous experience. It's not a marvelous experience. It's not, strictly speaking, an experience at all.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we cannot say that being is not known. If being was not known, we would all make the statement, I am not. Can anyone say honestly of their experience, I am not? Mm. No. It so deeply goes against our experience. Why? Because we all can say the self-evident experience that I am, the self-evident experience of being.
Thank you so much. And maybe a footnote, what is the difference between knowing and experiencing?
It's the difference between the screen and the movie.
Okay.
In the way that I use the words. In other words, experience is a coloring of knowing.
Oh, okay.
So the only you can have knowing without experience, but you can't have experience without knowing.
Okay.
You can have the screen without the movie, but not the movie without the screen. So experiencing is an objectification of knowing.
Okay.
But they're the same thing. One experience has a form, knowing has no form. And then with one exception, when I use the word the experience of being, strictly speaking, I shouldn't say that. I should speak of the awareness of being. But the awareness of being sounds a bit technical. So in order to make it experiential, I allow myself sometimes to refer to the experience of being, hoping that you understand that I don't by that mean an objective experience. All other experience, thoughts, feelings, sensations, perceptions, are what I call an objective experience. They have some objective content to them. The experience of being has no objective content to it.
Okay, that makes sense.
Okay, good.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
When my mind gets a little difficult, it will sometimes use the following argument for materialism. So when you are asleep at night, like deeply asleep, and something wakes you up, either, I guess, it's the morning and an alarm or the need to pee or something like that, it says this is evidence that physical reality, that sleep is, or deep sleep or the absence of things is a state, and that this is reality, that this physical reality has the power to pull you, that it is, rather than the other thing is less real, a state.
The waking, the world that we experience in the waking state mm-hmm. is real.
Yes.
It's just not real in the way that it appears to be.
I know my being, and yet it likes to say, this proves matter. It doesn't like to say this proves being. Or...
Okay. So you're deeply asleep. The alarm goes off.
Mm-hmm.
Does that experience take place in consciousness?
Yes.
You feel the need to pee. That's a physical sensation. Mm-hmm. Does that experience take place in consciousness?
Yes.
You get up. You go to the bathroom. Mm-hmm. You come back. Do you ever encounter anything that does not take place in consciousness?
No.
So what's the argument for the existence of matter, but which is defined as something that takes place outside consciousness?
Now,
Mary, can you find anything in your experience that takes place outside? Why don't you meet your mind with this question?
But it doesn't seem like deep sleep ever calls me out of this. Like, I mean, yes, I fall asleep, but this seems to call you out of
that may be so, that an experience, the alarm clock or a physical sensation has the experience to take you out of deep sleep, that may be so, but why does that fact persuade you that there is something called matter outside consciousness when you've never experienced that? Nobody's ever experienced anything outside consciousness.
Yeah.
I don't see why you're equating the...
Maybe because I like one better than the other, so...
maybe because you like one state better than the other.
Maybe that's why.
Well, that may be so, and that's perfectly reasonable to prefer one state to another. But again, it doesn't imply that there is something outside consciousness. When your mind is making the argument for the existence of matter, but it is one of the definitions of it is that which exists outside consciousness, and
you're right. There is
gives
nothing,
rise. Just test it out. Be scientific.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Be rigorous and scientific. Put that theory to the test. Okay, if there is something called matter outside consciousness, let's find it.
I haven't found matter or nothing.
Nobody ever has.
Yeah.
Some smart astrophysicist will get a Nobel Prize for saying that there's nothing outside consciousness.
In regards to the localization aspect, when I feel myself resting as pure knowing, the bodily sensations that I have arise in the same dimensionless and qualityless field of knowing that sounds do. But in a scene like this one, for example, it appears to me that there are many different finite minds that whose bodily sensations I don't feel and don't appear to me, even though there is only one consciousness, and only consciousness is conscious of itself. So I'm curious, are there like multiple streams, per se, like being known at a single time by consciousness?
Okay. I think I understand what you're asking. I would suggest there is one consciousness that is currently knowing whatever it is that all finite minds, all 8 billion of them, or if we include all the animals, all 8 trillion of them, there's one consciousness that is, so to speak, looking out through the eyes of 8 billion bodies. You might ask the question, well, why, if there's one consciousness, can I not experience everybody's thoughts or everyone's perceptions? In order to experience something, in order to perceive this room, for instance, you by definition have to perceive it from one point of view. If you were to take a snapshot of the room from your point of view now, it would be a coherent room. You would see the room that you now see. But imagine you were to take all of us were to take a snapshot of this room. There'd be 150 snapshots of this room. And imagine you were to overlay each snapshot on each other. It would no longer look like a room. It would be a blur. Imagine if you were to take 8 billion snapshots of the world now and overlay them all on top of each other. You wouldn't see a world. So in order to, there'd be no form, it would just be black. So in order for consciousness to experience form, a thought, a world, and it has to limit its field of perception. It must narrow its field of perception down to one point of view. When it has one point of view, then it can see the world. Consciousness, if you imagine consciousness as a wide open, unfocused field, as long as it's wide open and unfocused, because it's unfocused, there's no experience there. It's you imagine taking a camera and defocusing it completely. You look through it, there's just a white image, there's nothing in focus. But if consciousness wants to focus, in other words, if consciousness wants, doesn't really want to, but you know what I mean, if consciousness wants to experience form, it has to narrow the field of its focus, and it has to narrow it so narrow that it only has one point of view. Then it can perceive the world. So consciousness has to exclude all other possibilities in order to become a finite mind to know form. So the consciousness that with which you are experiencing your experience now, your experience is actually knowing the other 8 billion experiences that are happening, but it has had to narrow the focus of its attention so finely that it has excluded all those other experiences. It has pushed them to the periphery of your experience, so you are no longer aware of them. They're still taking place in consciousness, but the laser beam of your attention is so focused, because it's one point of view, that they are outside the periphery of the experience of your finite mind. Did that make sense?
Yeah.
I appreciate you clarifying that. And then the last part is when I feel myself in that state of resting as pure knowing, in one of our earlier meditations, you mentioned that at death there is no reunification with anything, that we are now what we have always been and will always be. And I'm curious because, again, that knowing is localized. So at the time of death, would it just be a stripping away of every perception that I have?
It's not really localized. It only seems to be localized because of the perceiving boundary around it. It's the perceiving boundary that makes you feel localized. The dream, you dream that you're on a Caribbean beach. You view the Caribbean beach from the localized perspective of the dreamed character that you seem to be. When the dreamed character that you seem to be on the beach closes his eyes, the beach disappears. When you open your eyes again, the beach appears. So you reasonably conclude in the dream that your consciousness is localized behind your eyes, in your head, in other words. In other words, you reasonably conclude that whatever it is that is perceiving the Caribbean beach is localized in your head. Then you wake up and you think, no, the consciousness with which I perceived the Caribbean beach was not actually localized anywhere in the time and space that seemed to exist in the dream. It was in a completely different dimension. So consciousness, when I say consciousness localizes itself, I sometimes add seems to localize itself. Your mind doesn't really localize itself in the Caribbean beach, but it seems to localize itself and become a separate subject of experience. And the unlocalized aspect of itself appears as the Caribbean beach. So I would suggest that we are all apparent localizations of infinite consciousness, and that what we perceive as the world is that aspect of consciousness that hasn't localized itself as a finite mind. This is the unlocalized aspect.
Yeah, that makes sense. I understand that our perceptions or our perceptive abilities are what make us feel to be a finite mind. So then I understand that consciousness is not localized in a body, but at the time of death, does the stripping away of all of those perceptions, I assume that only being is left. So is it just that feeling of pure being at the time of death?
Yes. If we concede that there is a finite space in this room, then it is legitimate to say that when this building is eventually demolished, the finite space in this room will reunite with the space of the universe. That's a legitimate thing to say with reference to the belief that the space in this room is finite. But if we take a sample of the space in this room, and we realize, no, that even now, the space in this room is not in this room. It is already the vast space of the universe. Then, when this building is eventually demolished, there's no question of this space reuniting with the vast space of the universe, because it is already that. So it's the same. If we credit the individual with an existence of their own, it is legitimate to say that when that individual is divested of its limitations, it will reunite with the infinite on death. It's a legitimate statement with reference to the belief that we are an individual. But if we realize that now we are not an individual being, we are already the only being there is, God's infinite being, then the idea of reuniting with God's infinite being on death doesn't make sense.
With the stripping away of our perceptive abilities, all that's left is pure being.
Not necessarily. Because there are deeper layers to the mind than simply our perceiving faculties. There is the, in Jungian terms, the personal unconscious and the collective unconscious. So the stripping away of our perceiving faculties, or the dissolution of our perceiving faculties at death, is like the dissolution of the outer edges of the whirlpool. The outer edges of the whirlpool that define it as a whirlpool disintegrate. At a certain point, the whirlpool loses its integrity. It's no longer a whirlpool. But the inner layers of the whirlpool don't dissipate completely. They may expand into the broader medium of the stream and still continue to exist in the stream as ripples rather than a coherent whirlpool. So I don't think it's as simple. Death is just as simple as the dissolution of our perceiving faculties, and we stand as infinite being. I think there's an intermediary realm where our perceiving faculties have dissolved, and therefore we no longer appear as a physical body. But there may be the mind may continue in some disembodied form in the broader medium of consciousness. the residual ripples that are left over from a dissolving whirlpool may float downstream and later coalesce to form the beginning of a new whirlpool, which would in time acquire new ripples, and at a certain stage it would appear as a physical body again. And that physical body would retain some of the characteristics of the previous whirlpool, because it is made of its residues. And that would account for some continuity of experience between two whirlpools, between two individuals. Think of it, that all these whirlpools in the river of consciousness, that they're all coalescing, dissolving, as they dissolve, the outer layers dissolve, that the ripples, the residual ripples, disband into the broader medium of the river. They float downstream, they mingle with other ripples that are left over from other whirlpools, and they coalesce. So each new whirlpool is not just constituted of a single dissolving whirlpool. Many residual whirlpools may have coalesced together. In fact, there's nothing to suggest that all the dissolving whirlpools don't leave some trace of themselves in the river, and that a part of all those residues goes into the make of each new whirlpool. In other words, we contain within us the whole of humanity. Everyone who has ever lived has left a trace of itself in us. That we are not really individuals, we are the growing edge of humanity. We contain everyone that has ever lived within us.